You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
My name is Chris Browning, and I am the only one in the room who is an actor who used to live in the bushes next to the 405 freeway. I went to this county place, and it was regimented, and it was rules, and everybody there was off the streets or right out of prison, and they didn't really care about my complaints. That was like the first time that I ever started to get right-sized. I had all this ego that I retained, being 60 pounds underweight and covered in abscesses and living in the bushes. I finally realized these losers that are here with you, those are your people. It was like, oh my God.
Imagine being a successful working actor, booking movie after movie, show after show, and being the envy of your peers. Chris Browning, American film and television actor, was living the dream before succumbing to an addiction so powerful that he ended up losing his home and began a life of homelessness, winding up in an encampment under LA's infamous 405 freeway. But what would you do if, while getting sober, there was a casting call for a small part in a big film, and they were looking for bad guys that needed to die? Would you decide to pass and wait for the kind of roles you've been playing before? Or would you take the part and become that guy that died in the movie you like?
Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they, too, had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Chris Browning, can you tell me, what's your biggest pet peeve?
I'd say lying.
Lying. Okay.
Which is surprising because I was so good at it for so long.
Uh-huh.
But if I stop doing it, everybody should.
Right. I agree. It's like, why lie about that, right?
Yeah.
When people are lying.
Yeah.
I've gotten to the point where I don't say I'm 5 minutes away when I haven't left my house yet.
Right. And those are easy to do.
Those are easy. But yeah. That's a fib, right?
Yeah. I'm not perfect. I'll do things, if especially if it's to keep from hurting somebody's feelings or
right.
Or you know, whatever. I'm not going to be brutally honest across the board.
Right.
That can be cold.
But when someone is
just lying to your face about something, it's kind of like,
yeah,
it's a deal breaker for you?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, because maybe it's because I'm afraid it'll rub off on me and I'll be back to being completely full of it all the time.
Right, right. I can totally understand that. Thank you for that. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. But I am never the only one in this room, because as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, Hun. So, about Chris, I just think it's really important that our listeners know how very responsible he is, because
I know.
This is actually a great story.
Not only did Chris show up on time, exactly on time, and he picked up the packages from Whole Foods that had been delivered to our gate and brought them up to the door, but he showed up one day early, right, Chris?
While we were in an interview.
We were actually in another interview, and we had no idea that Chris had been here and gone until after the interview ended. But we do really appreciate your being responsible and your promptness, too.
Yeah, well, I just like to do a rehearsal.
Yeah, yes.
Make sure.
You are an actor.
Yeah.
Got to get that rehearsal in. Yeah, I saw your email and I just literally laughed out loud. I didn't even have to type back LOL because I was really laughing out loud. You were lovely to come back a second day. Thank you.
I know. I was really hoping he'd have more stuff in his hand when we opened the
door today,
though. Sorry about
we were
that.
Supposed to be getting some deliveries. So we should have timed them, right? Uh-huh. And I can't start the interview without shouting out Simone Reyes.
Simone!
What's up, Simone?
And she was our guest in season 6, right, hon?
Mm-hmm.
No, season 5.
Oh, yeah, season 5.
No, season 6.
What's season?
You know, I'm just going to get on board this thing wherever I can.
And she talked about being the only animal activist that turned country music star. We were talking about that. She's definitely the only one who can claim
that. In this room and probably
many,
most others.
Many other rooms.
And yeah. Simone, we're still vegan. We're still eating
vegan. Yeah, we
are.
Seriously?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We stayed.
We went way past the 30 days.
We went way past the 30 days.
I've had multiple medical advice to stay in this diet. So
he's had a couple of incidents over the summer that the fix or the medication for it would be to eliminate animal products.
Yeah, the very first thing they ask you is what you're eating.
And
I say I'm eating vegan and they say, okay, well,
like, you're all right then.
Mm-hmm.
And she is really, truly, partially to thank for that because I think she influenced both of us, don't you think, hon?
She kind of made it okay to just make that final commitment, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, I really have to thank my dad, Dr. Ronald Cathcart, who's been a vegan most of my life.
Who was also a guest.
Who was also a guest.
You've got to have dad on the show.
Yes.
Well, she's definitely influenced me. I'm not a vegan, but I'm 90% closer than I was before I met her.
You're vegan-ish?
Yeah, vegan-ish.
I'm vegan adjacent.
You know, I tell people when they ask me about becoming vegan that we spent a long time sort of transitioning to that too, Chris, where we tried different things to see what we liked. We see how, you know, when we were ready to make that step, we already had a little history with our diet and what we preferred as vegan. So,
well, you know, there's so much out there too that you just don't know. Everybody's right, you know,
and
there's the thing out there about blood type and foods, and they say that, you know, O positive people should definitely eat meat. They should add products in their diet, and I just found out I'm O positive, so I'm like, maybe that's why. Because in the past, I've been, you know, with my first wife who was vegetarian, I became vegetarian, and sometimes I just craved it, like medicine.
Yeah, like you needed it.
Yeah.
I actually haven't craved it yet, and so maybe I don't need it. I don't know. I'm also doing it one day at a time. Mm-hmm. So we will see how it goes.
And she actually has an amazing chef that cooks for her every day.
He cooks for me every day. It's crazy.
I think that makes it a little easier.
It does. All right. So I'm going to introduce Chris so we can interview him. He's a Nevada native. Chris Browning is an American television and film actor known for character roles, specializing in more tough and rugged types, or as he says, I'm the guy that died in the movie you liked, which I love. You're not just from Nevada. You're from Reno. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, we lived in Tahoe at the time, but I was physically born in Reno because that's where the hospital was.
Okay.
And we lived in Tahoe and Reno
How close are they for people who don't know?
40 minutes.
Okay, so they're really close.
Yeah.
And Tahoe is in California.
Half of it.
Half of it.
Or, well, two-thirds
That's right, yeah. And the other half of this huge lake, this huge, beautiful lake. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd take you, you know, two and a half hours to drive around it.
Right.
It's, but I lived on the Nevada side in Incline Village. It's still, I mean, I've been all over the world. It's probably my favorite place.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. The fires really impacted it this time, that area, right?
It did.
Not in burning, but in the air quality up there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, well, the fire reached, the smoke reached New York.
Yeah. It actually, we saw that it reached like...
It reached Europe.
Europe.
Oh, come on.
It was amazing. You know, if you believe that the Earth is round, we were able to see.
Wait, that's
one of those fools.
That's a different episode.
That's buying into that.
It is a different episode. Yeah. If you believe the Earth is flat, please hit me up because I want to have you on the show. Tell me how you became an actor originally.
You know, it was something I was always fascinated with. I bounced around a lot as a kid. My parents divorced, and I was always like the new guy. And I seemed to be pretty socially awkward, and I just kind of fixed on TV from the time I was, you know, 5 years old. I would, you know, my parents would wake up and find that I snuck out of bed to watch, like, Creature Feature in the middle of the night, you know? And I loved going into that world in the TV. But I never thought I'd be an actor. I kind of did it on accident. I was done with college. I was bumming around. I still didn't have any degree in anything, and I'd been to college like 5 years. And I had all these different majors, and all I knew was what I didn't want to do, you know? And so I was working in a warehouse, just partying and, you know, getting high and drinking and having a job, you know,
right.
just working in this warehouse. And I was telling a guy I wanted to be a screenwriter. He goes, well, I had a friend that got into that business. He went to a school called the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And I said, okay, I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna go there. And I mean, it's kind of an embarrassing story now, but at the time I knew so little about it that I did the thing, and I moved and I went down there and I had to audition.
Where was it?
It was in Pasadena at the time. There's one in New York as well.
Yeah.
Now it's on La Brea, I think.
Yeah.
In 89, it was in Pasadena. So, and it should have been a clue that I had to do two monologues to get in, you know? And I did these monologues terribly. I thought that I got 100% on it because I got every word.
Right. Like you weren't really acting.
No.
You were just reciting.
I was reciting.
Yeah.
It was a memory test for me. And it was terrible. And the director of the school that was there, I mean, I didn't know how bad I was at the time because I didn't know what a monologue was. And I didn't know that I was supposed to be acting it. And she said, no. You know, here's some workshops. Come back next year. And that's kind of when I went into my monologue. I was like, well, wait, I'm the fastest learner I know. Just give me a chance. I've got everything I own is in my truck out there in the parking lot. I left my apartment.
Wow.
I quit my job. Came down here from Reno. And they said no. So then I was back in Reno, and I was staying at my dad's. And they called and said, you know what? I know school starts in like 3 days, but a slot opened up, and we wanted to give you a chance. Mm-hmm. So I was like, great. And I came back down.
Wait, had you done any work on your monologue?
No, I'd already done the monologue. No.
I mean, but you hadn't, like...
No, they weren't going to make me do it again.
Okay,
They were going to give me a chance.
Oh, so you can just... So they were saying, you're invited in.
You're invited in.
Yeah.
And I went down there, and I remember standing in the director's office and standing there telling her, well, I want to focus primarily on screenwriting and stuff. And she's looking at me like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, this is a theater school.
Right. It's a school for actors.
Yeah. Here's your schedule. Same as everyone else's. Focus on that.
Right.
So that was the whole first year. I was just this terrified, you know, football player who was trying to memorize Shakespeare. And they're saying, hey, we're going to be off book tomorrow and start blocking. We're going to start blocking, so get off book. And I was like, what's blocking?
What's off book?
What's off book? Yeah.
And can all you these just kids, explain what those two things are?
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody else, they were all, you know, wearing black and smoking.
Yeah.
Talking about John Malkovich.
And right.
You know, I didn't even know who that was. but they were helpful. And I just wanted to not go up on my lines. I just made sure I knew my lines. But at the end of the first year, they have these exam plays. And they either put you in like a lead in one and a small part in another, or two good size roles, or whatever. There's two plays.
Right.
And they put me in as John Proctor in The Crucible, which, you know, is mm-hmm. a main role. And I did that. And that was like the time that I finally got what people were talking about. Like, I went out there and I barely remember it. And I was that guy, and people I didn't know were hugging me and afterwards. And I was like, I want this.
Right.
This
is, you know. Right.
So it actually helped, because I was so terrified and shy. It helped me, which is something, you know, I've heard about since then, is people like Richard Dreyfuss, who, you know, throws up before he's going on the Tonight Show or something, because he's got to go out and be Richard Dreyfuss.
Right.
That makes sense to me. Like, this is scarier to me than playing some outlandish character in a movie, because that's him. You know?
Right, right.
But, you know, coming here and being me is scarier.
It's scarier,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So, anyway, I got invited back to second year, and they only take a quarter of the students back for second year. And so I was very happy that they saw enough growth to bring me back. And that second year is when I really kind of learned it, you know?
Yeah. How old were you at this time?
25, probably.
25.
Yeah.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
This episode's being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Sweet dreams are made of these.
Huh? Oh, I see you like your new silk sleep eye mask kit.
I love it. I'm so relaxed as soon as I put my mask on. And then the bedtime spray too, so good.
Oh, you mean that magic handcrafted spray that Melanie Apple makes with rosato and Roman chamomile?
That's right. And don't forget the ylang ylang. I also heard that she adds a dash of vetiver.
Honey, I'm not sure what any of those things are, but that spray does the trick. I'm asleep seconds after you spray our pillows.
It's my favorite thing about bedtime, besides sleeping next to you, hon.
No.
Voyage AC has absolutely everything you need. It has wonderful gifts, faux fur throws, beachwear, diffusers, clutches, beach bags, clothes, gorgeous mix and match gift boxes, and these marvelous new silk sleep eye mask kits. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VOYAGEETCIE.com.
Hey, and as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount
what?
To all our listeners right now. That's 10% off everything you buy.
All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
And then, so you talked about you have been kind of partying, working in the warehouse. Did you bring that partying with you to Pasadena?
Yeah. No, I mean, I drank alcoholically from the time I started drinking, you know, and I mean, I remember being like 12 years old and drinking three beers and puking all over the post office parking lot
Yeah. You drank them at the post office?
Yeah, I lived across the street from this post office.
Okay.
In Stoneboro, Pennsylvania. Yeah, Stoneboro.
Yeah. All right. Shout out to them.
800 people.
Yeah.
And I threw up everywhere on three beers, and I said, I like this.
You like that feeling.
I want more of that. So, yeah, from the time I was probably 15 when my friends started driving and I was off and running, but I could manage it. You know, I could regulate it because I did well in school and I did well in sports. And my dad had always made me a deal that he said, if you keep, you know, doing well in sports and getting good grades, you'll always have a car and you'll always have money in your pocket. I don't want to pay for college.
Right. You know? Right. He was going to supply that car and that money.
Yeah, that
for
was
you.
His okay. deal. That was the deal.
Yeah.
And it worked out great. He didn't pay for college and, you know, I got to get around and have money for beer.
Right, you know? Right.
So,
do you identify as an alcoholic?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And an addict.
And an addict.
Yeah, okay. Sure. You know, it's in my family. My mom was in recovery for 40 years. She got it her first try.
Right. You know? Wow.
I couldn't. It took me 12 years to get 90 days.
Yeah.
Because I just couldn't. I couldn't do it. People, you know, gave me suggestions and told me what to do. And I just somehow I maintained so much ego. You know, even after it got bad, like I get at the academy, I kept it together. I partied when it was party time and I worked and, you know, it didn't overlap much.
Right.
I wanted to keep it sacred, you know.
Did you go to meetings with your mom ever? Like,
one in our house.
You had one in your house.
We had one on Tuesday night meeting in our house. And so when I was going fishing and hunting and all that, you know, Pennsylvania stuff, it was with people, sober people.
Right.
You know? And it's amazing to me looking back, like how little I knew about how sobriety works.
Yeah.
You know, it was right there around me all the time. And I still had all these weird misconceptions that it was everybody living their plan B, you know?
Right.
Like these people, they wish they could be out at the bar and they can't. So they're huddled here in my house being miserable.
You felt sorry for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had no idea, you know, and it should have dawned on me, like, because, you know, I was in and out trying to get sober for 12 years and having a terrible experience every time.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't do any of the stuff that was suggested.
Right.
You know, so I was just what they call white knuckling.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like holding my breath. Sooner or later, I'm going to breathe again.
Mm-hmm.
It was never a good time. It was always just like, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. It never occurred to me like that guy that's got 20 years can't feel like I feel, or he wouldn't have 20 years.
Right.
He'd last a couple months, maybe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so what's he doing differently? What's different about him? And the difference is he doesn't want to get loaded anymore. And that was something, a concept that just never penetrated my thick head.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a long, ugly road. And then after the academy, I went to Hollywood, moved to Laurel Canyon with my buddy from school. And we had this little cottage up in the canyon and we were waiting tables and doing the actor struggle thing. And I loved waiting tables because I could just drink all the time.
Yeah. You know? Did you wait tables somewhere on Laurel Canyon or in the Hollywood area?
All on Hollywood.
Yeah.
And in places like.
Did you make good tips?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
But they were always gone. You know, I walked in off the streets into Morton's and got a job at Morton's.
Wow.
And
it's pretty fancy schmancy.
It was very fancy.
Yeah.
And I didn't care. I would still be like, why would these people leave a $700 bottle of wine on the table with half a glass missing?
You right. know?
And I'd take it back and literally chug it.
Oh, my goodness. Of course.
Yeah. I was like, wasting. You're wasting.
Totally. Help me out here. This is your lifestyle, right? You've finished your classes at the academy, right?
Yeah.
And you and your buddy are going on auditions and waiting tables and kind of living the bachelor life. Now you're probably like, what, 26?
Yeah.
27?
Yeah.
So there's a jump from there to being homeless.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my sister, she struggled a lot. And she ended up drinking herself to death at 27.
Oh, wow.
So I'm so sorry. Thank you. I was 29, and I was struggling to have an agent. I was so happy if I got like two words on Saved by the Bell.
And
I was thinking I made it.
Yeah. You know?
So I was still waiting tables, obviously. And then I got this lead in a miniseries in Russia.
Mm.
And it was right after my sister had died. And that took me to a place of like, I just don't give a shit anymore. I don't care. And
did you go?
I went.
Oh, wow.
I went and blended so well as a snot flying drunk in Russia because we could drink. Everybody drank. The crew, the cast, we all drank.
And yeah, it was ideal in a way.
Yeah. I'm lucky it didn't kill me because I would wake up and drink a half a liter of vodka.
Mm.
They have these little half liter bottles and I would crack one open. They don't even reseal. They have like a rip foil top on them thing. And
you're just going to finish it once you've opened it.
It's like a Pepsi.
Yeah.
The intention is right there.
Yeah.
And I would get a glass of juice in that bottle and I would pound them all in one.
Mm.
And that's how I'd start my day. And then I'd bring another one to work to nurse on because it was all action stuff. It was a Jules Verne, The Children of Captain Grant story, and it was 13 months in Russia. It was all sword fights and horseback, and you know, there were no conversations like this,
right?
You know,
right?
So I could be drunk,
mm.
and some of it was, you know, harsh. It was, you know, doing underwater filming in the Black Sea in February, you know, and it was they wanted me to drink,
yeah.
You know?
But well, for that, you would need to be need antifreeze in your veins,
yeah. So
how long were you there?
13 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Once I did that, because the other thing I didn't know, and I mean, I could just write a book on the shit I didn't know, you know,
but yeah.
And that was one, I didn't know that theater and TV and film were different sports.
Right.
You know,
right.
And for theater, you got to play to the balcony,
mm-hmm.
you know, with your movements and your voice and everything. So everybody can have the experience.
Yeah.
You know? You don't do that on TV or you look like you're having a seizure,
right?
You know, and it's just, I learned it in Russia. I got to make all the mistakes on this 12-hour miniseries and I'd see it on playback and I'd be like, oh, wow, that was way too big.
Right, you know? Right.
So when I came back, I was good at TV and film.
Mm-hmm.
So I immediately booked a sitcom. I was a regular on a sitcom and I'd had all this money that I'd saved.
Which sitcom was it?
It was called Hardball.
Oh, right, right,
It was a baseball thing, and you know, I'm a baseball nut, so
yeah.
I was so happy. We filmed one day a week at Angel Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
It was on right after The Simpsons on Sunday nights.
So cool.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm pitching off the mound at Angel Stadium. It was so much fun. But the drinking, because I had, you know, I had all this money, all this free time, because, you know, working a sitcom, you work 4 hours a day,
yeah,
you know? And you only work half the year,
right. Yeah.
So it was a lot for me to have. You know, I just thought I was bulletproof at that point, so mm-hmm. I started mixing a lot of cocaine into it, and then that show got canceled. On that show, I was kind of the dumb guy. I was like the Woody character. I was like the hayseed rookie pitcher. You know, the dumb guy. And I went to a show called In the House with LL Cool J and played the same kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like his white friend.
Yes.
And
yes, you were.
And it was the same kind of a character. You know, this gullible oaf.
How was that experience?
It was terrible.
It was?
It really was. Okay. I mean, I understand what racism feels like, you know? It was kind of...
Because you were the only one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just didn't... It wasn't a very loving... thing.
Yeah.
You know, I had plus I had so much fun on Hardball, you know,
right.
Being paid to play baseball. And,
yeah.
And
you were an athlete.
You
played football, you played baseball, anything else?
Motocross.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, you're
water ski
and
snow ski a lot.
Okay.
You know, being from Tahoe.
Yeah.
So
that all goes on your actor's resume, right?
Yeah.
That you have all these
abilities. Special skills.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Nobody wants me to play football anymore.
No.
Can you imagine?
No, I can't. It's messed up.
It's so messed up. So that was just such a miserable experience for me that I just didn't care anymore. I was just, you know, up partying all night, you know, doing coke and stuff and like watching my episode while like smoking cocaine, you know.
So I'm going to pause you there for a minute. Are you doing this solo? Are you with... Like, do you bring in people to party with you, or is it, because I don't know if it's partying if you're by yourself.
It's not partying. Yeah. Yeah, the party, you know, that was a funny, you know, good point, because I saw a new guy come in trying to get sober one time. All he said was, I don't know why they call it partying, man. And it was like, he said so much with that. And because the party was over, I was just drinking and using by myself. And I had a beach house in Malibu and... white as a sheet in August, you know, and I lived on the beach.
Yeah.
And because once I started smoking coke, it, you know, that's not a social thing for me. Some people can do it. Not me. I'm whispering and peeking out the window. And it's just,
I think by the end, for everyone, it's an antisocial thing.
Yeah. It was just so dark. And then I would knock myself out at night with some sedatives, and then I'd wake up with a half a dozen painkillers, and because I couldn't have anything on my breath because I was going to work, you know, and it was just this whole thing. And then, as I always say, then I tried heroin once for 6 years, and that's what took me to the streets.
Yeah,
because then it was like I just don't care. I found this, and you know what's really weird is that probably saved my life.
Heroin.
Yeah.
How come?
Because I was drinking so much liquor that I was puking blood.
Mm.
You're swirling close to the drain when blood's coming out of you, you know? And then I tried heroin and forgot about alcohol. I just didn't care. I became a thief. Everybody's got a hustle on the streets, right? And, and mine was, I stole liquor. I stole liquor and sold it to the Russian mafia in Plummer Park.
Oh.
And they have all these bars and restaurants. They'll take as much as I bring them.
Wait, so you weren't stealing, you weren't hooking like a bottle under your jacket. How were you stealing
No,
liquor?
I was stealing 6 bottles at a time.
How?
Well, you get the whole thing, but you get good at it. I would go get one of those razor blade scrapers from the like home section of Ralph's or Vaughn's or whatever. Get that little razor blade scratcher, and I would scratch a line through that square sticker, that alarm sticker.
Oh.
And if you just cut a line through it, because what that is a long antenna. If you look on the underside of it, there's a wire that gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's really like a 4-foot antenna.
Yeah.
So if you just cut it in half, scrape a line through it, it becomes like 51-inch antennas, you know, that don't work.
Useless, yeah.
They're useless.
Yeah.
So you scratch that off, scratch through that, and stuff it in your pants, that your oversized pants, and everything's oversized when you're a junkie.
Right.
You know? I didn't have to go find big pants. Everything I had. I look like a kid wearing dad's clothes.
Mm.
And then I had this fanny pack over that, and I'd put a couple in that. And I could get 4 across and 2 in the fanny pack, and I'd go out to the car and drop them off.
Wow.
And then go in and get 6 more. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go across the street to the next, because they're always like, seem to be close to each other all the way up the freeway. I'd go all the way up to.
You were working.
Entering. Yeah.
So you like got up, got your clothes on and went to work.
Yeah.
Stealing and selling, and that was the hustle.
Yeah, but I could make, you know, I was making $1,000 or $1,500 every day.
Damn.
And I'd wake up broke, and I couldn't get it together to live in a motel. Like, I'm still living in the bushes.
Wow.
It's like,
so know. Tell me about your first night outdoors. Did you think it was temporary? Were you set, like, this is cool?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember thinking, wow, being, like, in a homeless encampment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a stretch of 200 or 300 yards between an elevated freeway and a strip mall and mechanic shops and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And there's like a little strip of, you know, as wide as this room that just goes down a couple hundred yards, and there's trees on the hillside that goes up to the freeway, and and there's people camping, you know, back there.
In tents and
now there's a lot more tents. Back then it was a lot of tarps and
you know,
I think they're more accessible.
Yeah. Now there's a bigger demand. And the difference between now too is 95% of us there at the time, this is, you know, in late 90s, early 2000s, we were there because we were drunks and drug addicts. You know, now half the people out there lost their homes and they're, you know, the economy screwed them.
Right, right.
But they're not all drug addicts. It used to just be that.
Right.
So when I was back there and I was seeing all these characters and that freedom of, I had nothing in my pocket. I didn't have a wallet. I didn't have a key to anything. I didn't have a time to be anywhere. I thought, this is great.
You thought this is great.
This is great. I mean, once I was high, you know, yeah, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be like, I'm a pathetic drug addict sleeping on a pissy mattress that I found on the sidewalk.
Right.
And, you know, then I'd do some heroin and I'd say, I'm camping.
Right, right.
Yeah, this, you know, and then later you realize that, no, you don't really camp in the valley.
No.
It's not.
It's not permitted for that.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah. But it would change. It was an instant mind change, you know, that once I got high, it was all fine. And I was like, this is life experience. You know, I could never explain this to somebody. I'm going to get out of here. I'm passing through. Someday I'm going to write about this.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And, I just didn't know it was going to be so many years. And
yeah, 6 years is a long time.
And half of that was in jail.
Oh, in spurts?
Yeah.
Okay.
Installments.
Yeah, installments.
Yeah.
You would get caught doing something and then you'd be sentenced for a short period of time. Like how long?
Yeah. I mean, it like up 30 days and sometimes in and out in a week.
Right.
Sometimes one time I did a year. It's a long time.
That is a long time. You did that here in Los Angeles County?
I did 9 months of it in LA County. And then when I was getting released, I was like, finally, I'm out of here. And I'm putting on my smelly clothes from 9 months ago
that were
in a bag for 9 months.
No.
And I was happy to. You know? And I put those on. And then I went through one last little door. And I saw two Ventura County deputies waiting
for me. They were waiting for you to get out so they could nab you?
So they cuffed me up and brought me to Ventura, where I owed another 3 months.
Wow.
So
you paid your debt.
I paid my debt.
Yeah. So I know when you and I talked on the phone, I was pretty fascinated by your relationship with your mom during this time period. Because you would call her at times, right?
Yeah. It got to where, you know, she had done that with my sister, too. My sister would just call her when she was drunk, and she would have all these, you know, things. And she finally, for her own sanity, had to kind of let her go.
Yeah.
You know, and mom and dad had long since stopped enabling me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to be able to get a little something from them, you know, occasionally if I had a real good emergency, you know. But, you know, they were long hip to that, and it wasn't happening anymore. And she just kind of cut me off long time ago, earlier financially, but also just emotionally.
Mm.
You know, she was like, if you ever want to get help, you know, call me. Here's what happens. So I, on the streets, you know, people say, like, what happened? You know, and they ask what happened. And you hear that a lot. And the thing that happened with me was more of a, you know, I always had these, when they say bottom, you know, you hit a bottom, right? Well, I hit so many that, you know, and in 2004, I finally got off the streets. And it wasn't my worst situation, but this time, best definition of bottom I've ever heard is you reach a bottom when circumstances around you are declining faster than you can lower your standards.
Yes, yes.
You know, I love that. And it just finally was like, okay, you're right. You were right 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And there was a guy, Gus, and I talk about him in my book. I'm writing a book about this, but
as you should.
That's what it was. It was this guy, Gus, who was talking to me one day, just like any other day. He was a homeless dude who was an alcoholic. He was all yellow, jaundiced, and skinny, and he was probably 30, and he looked 60.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he had that boyish thing. I always say that, you know, like, you could see the little boy with the skinned knee.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And even though he's drinking himself to death. And he said, you know, they're gonna catch me again, and I'm going to go back on a violation in, you know, 6 months, 9 months, maybe a year, whatever, on a parole violation, and then I'm going to run. I'm going to get out again, and I'm going to run. I'm not trying to have a job or piss clean for the man and, you know, all this, you know, have an address.
Right.
All this shit, like losers,
you
know. And I just started, while he was talking, I remember the thoughts going in my head, like, he was probably talking like I'm talking mm-hmm. at some point yeah. where I'm just passing through. Yeah. This is temporary.
Yes.
And then what happens if tomorrow if I wake up and I'm talking like Gus?
Right.
Who's getting me out of here?
Nobody.
You know? And nobody.
Yeah.
And that scared me. So I got out and finally did the stuff that people told me to do, and mm-hmm. and life got good. I went to a county place. You know, the union wasn't sending me to resorts anymore. You
right,
know,
right.
I was in a county place down in Long Beach, and they had rules, and they didn't
care. You mean the Screen Actors Guild, right?
Yeah.
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 So they provide insurance so that people can go get
yeah.
help.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've spent some money on me
yeah.
over the years, mm-hmm. but that was done. And I went to this county place, and it was regimented, and it was rules, and everybody there was off the streets or right out of prison, and they didn't really care about my complaints, you know? I remember going at them with some shit that I would have tried, you know, at Betty Ford. It
right.
might have worked.
Right.
And she and I remember this director, she said, you know what, then you need to pack your shit, boo. Somebody else needs your bed.
Ooh.
And I was like, don't you know who I think I am?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And yeah. she did not care.
She did not care. Yeah. So that was like the first time that I ever started to get right-sized.
Mm.
You know, I had all this ego that I retained, being 60 pounds underweight and covered in abscesses and living in the bushes, and I still knew more than that guy.
Wow.
You know, and
yeah.
I finally realized, you know, these losers that are here with you, those are your people.
Mm-hmm.
People, drug addicts off the streets. That's yeah. what you are. And it was like, oh my God.
Right. Well, that's what I am.
It really is what yeah. I am. Yeah. Yeah. Unbelievable ego.
Mm.
You know, and so when I got out of there, I had all my stuff in bags. I was a homeless guy. So I'm out of I've got 3 months for the first time in my life.
Wow.
And
what year was this?
In 2004.
In 2004. That's right. Okay.
And I called my mom and I asked her if I could come and stay with her. And she said yes, and I got out there. She helped me get out there, and she was in Florida. And she told me, she said, I could tell on the phone that I had my son back,
mm-hmm.
you know? And mm-hmm. I called her with all kinds of ideas before, and she wasn't biting, but she could tell.
Yeah.
And I stayed with her for 6 weeks because there were a lot of hurricanes, and I had to get her moved into another place while her house, you know.
Mm.
So it was about 6 weeks, and I had money to start my life over because my old manager was a guy named Noel Marshall, who was more like a father to me. He's dead now, but he produced The Exorcist. And
oh, love that movie.
Yeah, but he had a soft spot for addicts. You know, mm-hmm. I think his sons had some history of something. But mm-hmm. but he also, you know, he raised Melanie Griffith, and he was married to Tippi Hedren for 20 years. You know, and he kind of took me under his wing, and he had 20 grand for me.
Wow.
Said I wasn't going to give it to a junkie.
Ah.
And I was like, oh, thanks.
Oh, he held it out.
Money. Yeah.
Wow, yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah, because I would have blown it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I got a vehicle in Florida, and I was driving back to L.A., and I stopped in Taos, New Mexico.
Which is gorgeous.
As soon as I came up over the hill and I saw the Mesa and Taos Mountain, and Taos is still 10 miles away, and everything just went. And I was like physically going, what? And I said, I'm living there.
And you were not headed there.
I was headed back to L.A.
Yeah.
You know, to get famous, you know. And I saw Taos and I said, forget it. I'm going to I'll build adobes, go to meetings, just have a quiet little life, mm-hmm. you know, and not die.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the first time that I ever put recovery first,
mm-hmm.
ever.
Yeah.
And
Taos is one of those spiritual vortexes, isn't it?
Yeah. 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 Which I thought was a bunch of woo-woo until I felt it.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, this is, and it still has a hold of me, and I've been gone for 10 years, but that was the year that New Mexico started a tax incentive to bring productions to the state.
As it would happen.
So I got pulled back in. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was how come I'm always the guy who died in the movie you like, is because they come with, you know, like Book of Eli comes with, you know, they've got Denzel and Gary Oldman, their lead villain, and Mila Kunis and all mm-hmm. their stars. And who's left in a post-apocalyptic movie except people who die, you know?
The hijack
bad
leader.
Guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I got got to be the hijack leader. That's why that's my handle on social media.
Yes, I figured that out because I looked it up and saw how you were cast in there, and it says hijack leader.
Hijack leader
under your name.
Yeah, and I just always thought that was so cool that such a nondescript name, like a role that's so small he doesn't even have an actual name, that was so pivotal for me. That was like the day that I saw that I could play with the big boys.
Yeah. You know? And so you got part after part after part, right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of that stuff was local hire in New Mexico,
right,
where I was like the biggest fish
in a small pond.
In a small pond. I mean, everyone, when that incentive came along, everybody became an actor and they had their bullshit resumes with their fake credits and, you know, their headshots. But I'd actually already been, you know, I starred in a 12-hour miniseries. I had a couple of sitcoms. I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
So I booked 90% of the
stuff.
You
were a hot commodity then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was happy to work for scale, and I lived like a king in New Mexico.
Yes.
Working for scale, you know. It was a great, great way to start. It was a very healing place, and I have so many friends there.
Yeah.
You know? I remember my ex, Sarah, she had 3 months, and I had 4 months and when we met.
Mm.
And people are like, oh, be careful, you know, but it worked. We had a lot of good years together, and we had like the first adult grown-up relationship I'd ever had, you know, when I was 40.
Yeah.
You know,
and you and she are still friends,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're good friends. We've got two daughters together that are Lydia and Elena, who are 11 and 9.
Yeah.
And my second wife, Chrissy, we have baby Stella. She's 2.5.
2.5. Yeah. I was going to ask you, talk to me about being a dad.
That's my best thing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
I remember asking people, how much time do we have? I was going to tell you the story. I can go on for that. But I kept asking people about that. And I remember that they would start to tell me and they'd give up.
About what it's like being a parent or
being
a dad?
Being a dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
They'd go, well, you know, it's like, and they'd go, you know what, man, you'll
see. Yeah.
And then that day came and I'm like, that's what they meant.
Mm.
Like, I couldn't describe this to somebody.
Right.
Instantly, there's this little being that you would instinctively, reflexively throw yourself in front of harm's way for.
Yes.
Without even thinking about it. You'd just be like, oh, my God, I'm flying through the air towards a gun.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, you'd like to think that, you know, with your wife or your, you know, whatever, that you would do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a thought process.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, I'm going to be heroic and save her, you know. But you have to think it and do it.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is just, you'd be doing it.
Right.
And it's a trippy physiological thing that I didn't expect. And I love it. And I love being the silly dad and making silly YouTube videos and and just playing. My girls are great, you know. And
how do you do the not silly stuff, the homework and the clean your room and that kind of stuff? Are you okay with that?
I am. But, you know, we're doing co-parenting, you know,
because
we've been apart. Sarah and I split up, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago.
And
we're good. You know, we congratulate ourselves on co-parents of the year.
Yes.
Every year, you know, because these girls, they're really well-adjusted little people. And I don't know, they're loved. They want to please. They want approval and they get it. We just have fun. I'm not like super strict with them, but they know when I'm serious.
They do.
Yeah.
They respond when you're serious about something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, they've had so all this time of me being silly where if I'm like, you rotten punk, you know, they know that I'm kidding.
Right.
And just wait. They'll start laughing at you soon.
they do. They already do. But they, I don't know. It's, they're good people. I always tell this story I was with Lydia. I don't know where Elena was. I just had Lydia in the car with me. And we were in Topanga heading over to the valley to go to the store. And we see this girl, probably 20-year-old, you know, whatever, girl hitchhiking with a backpack. So it's a really hot day. So, you know, it's Topanga. That's like how people get around.
Right.
So we pick up this girl and she's...
Topanga's really like hippie. It's lost in time.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like I don't lock my doors or anything, you know, And Lydia was riding. She was 9, but she's tall. And she's riding in the front seat because her sister's not there and she's being a big girl. So she's in the front with me and this girl gets in behind her. And right away I noticed that she's not all there. Like she's kind of talking to herself and laughing at things that aren't being said. And so right away, I'm kind of worried. I'm thinking like, you know, I'm worried about like, you know.
And your daughter's right there.
Yeah. And that kind of dissipated in a hurry. I wasn't worried about that so much. And I could just tell that she's homeless and the world had been hard on her. And I don't know if there's drugs, but this girl was like abused, you know. And she was definitely mentally ill. So we get to we're like, where do you want to go? And she's like, you know, wherever God takes you, you know, takes me or something. And I'm like, well, God's taken us to
the store. Yeah. the grocery store. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we get her there and I'm like, hey, come in with us. We'll get you some beverages. You know, it's real hot day. And and she was sheepish and afraid. And Lydia was like, come on. And so she kind of followed us around. She wouldn't walk with us, but we would look back and she'd be, you know, talking to herself and laughing, but still kind of closed. And we get to the place where the drinks are and stuff. And I'm like, how about some of these? Do you want? And she's gone. So I'm like, where'd she go? And Lydia goes, there she is. And she's on the other end of the store. So Lydia says, I'll go get her. And I'm watching from my side of the store. And it's all, I can't hear them, but I can see Lydia going, you know, it's okay. And she's kind of holding her hand up. And I don't know what she was saying, but the girl hesitantly putting her hand out for my daughter. And Lydia's leading her across the store, right? And every time I tell that story, it just chokes me up, you know, because I'm sober, because I'm living a life, you know, by trying to live the right way, you know, and living by a set of rules, you know, and trying to be honest and not lie, cheat, and steal anymore, you know. That's the person that she's influenced by, and that's why she's that young lady. You know, she's not trying to take advantage of her. She's not trying to, you know, we're not laughing at her. She doesn't even have that in her. You know, she doesn't tease her. And, you know, she, like if I were still out
there. She's not rolling her eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I were still the old guy that I was, you know, we'd have gotten her backpack or something.
Right.
You know what I mean? It would have just been like, take.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she doesn't. And I watched that girl be that person. And I'm just so grateful.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
That's always a beautiful story. It really is. Mm-hmm. Well, and it personifies what you're talking about. And to have that added image of your daughter is just another layer to the picture that I have now of the man that you are. You said that you were going, did you say you're going to a rehearsal in Tarzana yesterday?
No, I was going to, I had an audition. Natasha Henstridge, do you know, you guys?
Yeah, I know who she is.
Yeah, she's a really good friend. And hi, Natasha.
Hi, Natasha. Shout out to you. We had kids together at Buckley, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She's in Tarzana. And I had this really cool audition come up. And I'm like, I want to get somebody good to read with me.
She's great.
If it's important enough, I'll bug her with it.
Yeah. You know?
And this thing was like, wow, if the other person reading is good, and because there's a lot of banter in these scenes, and it's for a big deal, you know, regular on an HBO show, and it's like, yeah, I could get this one, and it seems right for me. So, I went over there actually earlier than I planned on because you guys weren't weren't here for me.
Yes. Well, we were but not for you.
I was about to get defensive there.
Yeah.
So I went over there and we worked on it till dark and got some good stuff. I was proud to turn it in.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. And so you are auditioning and acting now?
Yeah.
That's your main focus?
That's all I've done. And voiceover.
And voiceover, okay.
Yeah.
And being a dad. Which is beautiful. I'm excited to hear your conversation with Scott because I actually have so much more that I want to talk to you about, but we have to wrap this part up.
Oh.
It has been a delight. I was so into your story. I was so into listening to you that I'm on the edge of my seat, literally, as you know. What's next? I kept forgetting to even just use my notes because I was just really into what you were telling me. And it's such a good story. You need to write that book.
I'm 60,000 words in.
Yes.
But Tana says that 60,000 is plenty for a book, but I'm going to write 90 and then whittle down.
I like that approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Editing is good. It's always better to get everything out, right?
Yeah.
And then reel back from there.
Yeah.
Tell me where people can find you.
Find me on Instagram at Hijack Leader, H-I-J-A-C-K Leader.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on.
I had a great time. Sorry I hijacked everything there. I didn't
know. But that's your handle.
Oh, that's what I do.
That's what you do.
That's what
Thanks,
I do.
Chris. Thanks for coming
the Hijack
out.
Leader. The Only One in the Room has brand new interviews for you every week. You won't want to miss our full episodes every Tuesday, Scott Talks on Wednesday, and our new Thursday series, The Now Normal. And twice per month, be sure to catch our 30-minute Sunday edition by subscribing to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Join our Only One in the Room Facebook group if you'd like to tell us about your Only One story. All of us at The Only One in the Room wish you safety and wellness.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.